Welcome to another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick, leader of the Law, Religion, and Heritage Research Program team in the University of Southern Queensland School of Law and Justice. This bi-monthly podcast is all about the fascinating and complex interactions between the worlds of law and faith in Australia. And every episode features an interview with a different guest. My aim is to provide insight and perspectives from across the spectrum of religious and ideological beliefs. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Joel Harrison, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Sydney. Joel specializes in constitutional law and has a special interest in its relationship to theological concepts and history. He is also the author of an important new book from Cambridge University Press titled Post-Liberal Religious Liberty, Forming Communities of Charity. The book articulates a very different justification for religious liberty than that provided by mainstream liberalism. And it suggests that our modern legal frameworks for protecting religious liberty need to be reoriented accordingly. I've asked Joel to come on the podcast to talk about his book and how he believes we should understand religious liberty moving forward. Joel, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jeremy. Great to be chatting with you.
Well, I read your book very recently, and I was very interested to see your understanding of the liberal concept of religious freedom and how you think it should evolve in a different direction to better protect individuals and religious associations. So I guess I thought I'd start with maybe a sort of a basic question. We may have some students listening or others. How would you sort of articulate the current liberal understanding of religious freedom?
So there's probably multiple liberal understandings, but I think one way to maybe capture that is a case you'd be familiar with as well. It's a case called R and a Big M Drug Mart, which was a case in the Canadian Supreme Court. And Justice Dixon, just before he became Chief Justice, talked about what religious liberty was about. And he talked about it like an evolution that had taken place over time, right? And he said it originally starts with the notion that a minority person or an individual may find themselves in a context where the civil authority promotes one kind of religion, and so they need protection, they need toleration. And then he says it shifts from there to an understanding that individual conscience matters and that's been seeded in the person by God. Right, the person's relationship to God and their determination of what God demands of them. And then he says that now then that shifts and evolves again to an understanding that personal autonomy itself is sort of foundational to our understanding of the political community. And that, I think, really traces quite well a sort of standard liberal narrative, right, about what religious liberty is. And you can see in that narrative, it tracks kind of certain religious thought as well, especially like in Protestant thinking around, the two kingdoms, with someone like Luther talking about the conscience, someone like Madison in the United States talking about the importance of conscience there. And then talking about personal autonomy, you get someone like Ronald Dworkin in a contemporary period will say, what does the political community exist for? Or exists essentially to reflect an understanding of ethical individualism, right? The independence of the person, their authenticity and their self-respect and things like this, right? So the liberal understanding then starts with notions of individual conscience, perhaps, but it's kind of evolved from that into an understanding that, say, religious liberty is really about something more capacious, something like personal autonomy or something like authenticity or the integrity of the person. And this has put real pressure on what it means to talk about religious liberty, because are we simply just talking about some broader category of ethical freedom?
Yeah. So the liberal understanding of religious freedom, as you say, is very focused on individual autonomy, individual conscience. And I guess maybe that fits into sort of other liberal understandings of constitutional rights, such as freedom of speech, very much individual focused and the right to express oneself, privacy linked to autonomy, things like that. In your book, you title it Post-Liberal Religious Liberty. Is that a descriptive statement that you think we're moving to a post-liberal understanding, or is that more an aspirational that you think we should move to a post-liberal understanding?
Oh, good question. I think maybe I'd say little column A, little column B. I mean, okay. Yep. Post-liberal in the sense of trying to maybe identify something that is taking place and some sort of competition that is taking place over liberal categories, right? That is some challenge that's being posed to liberalism. And then in the context of religious liberty, liberal understandings of religious liberty. And then also challenges within the case law. So although I've articulated that liberal understanding, you still see other conceptions at work as well. So in the European Court of Human Rights cases, you get a very strong line of cases that are about kind of group pluralism, right? Group pluralism, the authority of groups to cohere within a civil society, right? So there are these competing strands going on. But then, so that's in that sense, there's something descriptive going there, I hope. But also, yes, you're right. This is projecting a vision, right? This is trying to say that we need to move beyond these liberal categories to think in a different manner, and in a manner that doesn't necessarily reject all the problematics or all the questions that have been raised by liberalism, but certainly try something different.
Well, I really like the phrase in your book that you're talking about, a sort of, I think you used the term political imaginary, a sort of new way of understanding or framework for looking at religious freedom. I guess before we get into the proposal in the book, what do you see as perhaps the need for change? What are the problems of the liberal understanding of religious freedom that make you feel like, you know, we need to move in a different direction?
So there's 2 points there, I think, and one actually touches on your reference there to political imaginary. So political imaginary, you know, is about how do we see ourselves associating with one another in a way that forms a hopefully a better community, right? How do we understand the relationship between groups, individuals, and political authority? How do we narrate that, right? So that's the first thing I'm suggesting is problematic. And the more I think about my book, the more I think of it as almost just a work of sort of, you know, more like political theory in ways. But it's a suggestion that actually the understanding of political community that you find in dominant liberal thinking may be something that we don't want. So it's a challenge at that level, right? So when Ronald Dworkin says we need a new understanding of the commonweal or the res publica, and he means by that a respect for ethical independence or ethical individualism. And you see this in the work of someone like Cecile Laborde or someone, or various other liberal egalitarians, right? There's a real question, I think, over, well, is that the kind of society that we actually want? Do we want a society that actually does not have a conversation over what is the good for the political community? You know, there's wider conversations here about, you know, is that kind of understanding, does it really echo a sort of free market capitalism in which what is of value is ascribed by the individual's will, what the individual determines is of value, rather than an understanding that there are goods to be pursued together. So there is a question there, I think, about liberalism and its understanding of political community, what kind of society we want to have. And then that drills down into the second, which is really becomes a focus of the book, about its understanding of religious liberty. And so basically the argument here is that the sort of liberal egalitarian account of religious liberty is becoming exhausted. As I mentioned, that sort of lineage that Justice Dixon articulated, right, it moves towards a more capacious understanding of personal autonomy. Then you get a real question, oh, well, if we're really about protecting personal autonomy, then why care about religious liberty at all? Why not just simply be interested in, say, well, as it turns out to be, the law as a general standard reflects the interests of all individuals, and so should equally apply to all individuals and all groups. Even more than that, you get into arguments that say, well, if we're really concerned about personal autonomy, then maybe we should really be really more fundamentally concerned about reforming religious groups that are sort of recalcitrant, that don't conform to this forms of personal autonomy or self-determination. So we get cases about, you know, people who work in leadership or pseudo-leadership positions in churches, and they start acting contrary to the vision and ethos of that body. Does the church have to respect their self-determination? You know, questions like that, right? So there's a real challenge that then it poses to religious communities. And then I think that as a wider idea of sort of concerns we're about, they even find obviously in liberal writing, if we're concerned about pluralism and how do we manage or how do we accommodate or how do we respect or how do we make these different components of our community cohere, then that arguably undermines it, right? If you start saying that actually everyone just must simply conform to a universal rule that's basically about forms of self-determination or personal autonomy.
So is it fair to say that you have a sort of deep theoretical critique of the liberal understanding of religious freedom, but there's also a concern that the current understanding leads to wrong decisions in practice, and that you're concerned about maybe, are there, you gave, I think, one example. Are there examples of cases you think issues that have been sort of wrongly determined because of this focus on individualism or autonomy right. to the detriment of larger concerns or interests?
Yeah, I think so. So I think the first point to say here is that, as I mentioned before, I think case law isn't always univocal here, right? It speaks in sort of different ways. So you do get these very strong strands in European decisions about institutional autonomy for the sake of the primacy of civil society in ways, or something like that, right? Or a sort of social pluralist understanding, as I try to say in the book. And then you get other cases that I think fit quite nicely with what I'm saying. So, a case like Begum in the United Kingdom, House of Lords at the time, now Supreme Court. It's all about whether she can wear a stricter form of Islamic dress in this Islamic school, right? And part of the reasoning in that decision is it goes into saying, well, no, the school here has done its due diligence. It went and talked to the community around it, right? It had a consultation process in which it talked to different leaders of the Islamic community to determine what should be the dress and so on. And then the question is, should she be, as an individual, allowed to have her stricter one where it represented certain problematic features? So it was argued, right? And you get this in case law again. You get the case of Guy in the United Kingdom again, where it's about whether a Hindu can have an open air burial, funeral pyre. And, and again, they go and look to, well, what is actually happening in the Hindu community? What kind of conversation is happening there? What kind of thing do they want? And so there's a more collective or more community oriented approach there. So there are strands. But yes, you're right. Like at times, there would be differences. So I the case I always find fascinating, because it just strikes me as so wrong, is a case called Shute in the European Court of Human Rights. He was the organist and liturgical worship director for a Catholic parish in Germany. And he left his marriage breakdown, and then he started a relationship with another woman. And in the church's eyes, the Catholic Church saw that as bigamy. Right, he had an annulment, so he's engaged in bigamy, and so they release him, fire him, from being the parish organist and leader of liturgical worship. Right, now the European Court of Human Rights comes back and says, "Well, actually, Church, your process here is not right. You needed to engage in a balancing of interests. Yes, there is the Church's autonomy interest here, but there's also the self-determination of the individual, right, under Article 8, his privacy, his right to family life, and so on. They refer to it as a self-determination. Now, I think that's fascinating, because it basically is saying to the Catholic Church there, who's the initial decision maker, of course, that you must consider his individualized conception of Catholicism. You must consider that he can be a Catholic, but is in his own distinctive way. And that, to my mind, really just undermines the notion that the very idea of when the Catholic Church would talk about, say, Catholicity or something, the idea that they embody something together, right? That there are forms of hierarchy, and also there is a community that is doing something together, right? So I lean more towards their notions of, decisional autonomy for the group there. And there are other cases like that. And then down at the individual level, in the book, I would disagree with a case like Liddell. Liddell is about the civil registrar who objected to presiding over civil partnerships in the United Kingdom when it was civil partnerships at the time of same-sex marriage had become law. And she was a evangelical Christian. And the court says, no, she can continue, basically says something like she can continue with her rites of worship and so on and prayer in the context of religion, but she's entered it into a secular space now. Namely the space of civil celebrant for the local council. And so at that point, she's now subject to the rights and interests of all individuals, across the whole community. And I think that that's a problematic understanding of how we think about the public life, right? What constitutes a public life? Well, she's not outside of that, right? And so she could be actually, we could think of that in a different way, in a manner that says, well, she is also contributing to and part of our public life.
So it sounds from some of the examples you gave that part of the issue is the, as you say, the liberal egalitarian commitment to individual freedom and equality, and maybe a liberal push for equality has created tensions with the group versus the individual. And you think perhaps the liberal understanding of religious freedom weighs the individual conscience too heavily at the expense of the group's interests. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, in part. I think it's about, you know, whether the group should be a vehicle for that individual autonomy. So in liberal egalitarian thought, the group is only understood as the basket or the bundle of individual interests,
right,
that simply contract and cohere together. So another example of that is JFS, case in the United Kingdom Supreme Court. A Mazorti Jewish boy wanted to attend a Orthodox Jewish school. According to Orthodox Judaism, he is not Jewish because he was not descended. He did not descend from an Orthodox Jewish mother or did not convert under Orthodox auspices, right? Now, the Supreme Court, for various reasons, talks about this as it's actually ethnic or even racial discrimination against him. And in the course of that, they articulate that the school had to give voice to the individuality of his interests, right? His understanding of his religion. Religion is about, the court says, his personal choices here. And that turns the school into a vehicle for that, right? In the same way for Shute, the church there is turned into a vehicle for his individual interests. Or in the same way that people talk about, say, Catholic adoption agencies have to take account of the wider public at large, namely that there are people in the community that would be offended or their dignity would be harmed by the notion that somebody wants to only serve heterosexual couples, for example, right? And so in this way, the law becomes sort of a vehicle for the group having to accord, or the group having to understand itself as a vehicle for individual interests or autonomy.
And so maybe, I guess, getting to the thesis of your book, how do you think, what should be done? How should society understand religious liberty? It's a big
question. I sometimes think of my book. Well, I think what you're tapping into for me is my book in some ways has far too many theses. But I think, I mean, if I could boil it down, I'd have to say something like religious liberty has to be, in my mind, has to be grounded on the political community's commitment to religion as a good.
Okay.
All right. So rather than abstracting it into something else, religion is a good. Now, I do make an argument in the book that the liberal understanding is not divorced from religious accounts, right? It doesn't arise from nowhere. In fact, I think I say it is a political community's commitment to a version of religion. But what I'm saying is that what we want is then to choose the kind of religion that we're committed to, or the idea of what religious liberty is in service of, what the good of religion is here. And so then I try to argue that religious liberty serves a community trying to pursue solidarity, fraternity, and charity, or what we could understand broadly as right relationship with God. Now, I try to understand that that means that religion then has a sort of infrastructural good. That means it's an architectonic good. It's something that is not just kind of a good amongst others, but something that is actually what people see as the end, right? Their purpose. And then that becomes complicated because it's a case of, well, how do we pursue that good? And so how does religious liberty facilitate this? And I try and argue that it facilitates it by allowing for the free creation of communities, right? Communities that are going to pursue this good, that are in relationship to one another because they form a political community together, but they are in a certain relative autonomy that allows for the understanding that there are multiple levels of authority within our society.
So it's the proposal would be that society, as you say, needs to recognize right religion, the value of religion, not as simply one individual choice among many, but make a public commitment towards empowering people to find true religion or find their spiritual, to conclude their spiritual journey, something like that.
Well, I mean, I say it in that kind of, I don't think you can have, I don't think you can invoke religion in a kind of abstract way.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I think when we say religion, we're drawing on different central cases. Now, when I say central cases, that does mean that you can have analogies and that there are family resemblances or there are similarities. You know, it's not shared difference, but you are invoking it in a way that's you can't just. I think any attempt, all these attempts you find in legal literature to define what religion is, I think they, you know. It's fine to try and define it in the sense of, but you always have to be mindful that when you're doing so, you're drawing from something that excludes other things. So yes, a political community that is committed to religion. And this is why at the end of the book, I have the quite alarming feature for some people, which would be where I say, look, what does that look like in different political communities? It may look different depending on where you are. In the United Kingdom, there's an established church. Now, that's actually served it quite well, I think. In Australia, what would it look like? Well, as you know, we have our non-establishment commitment at the federal level, but that doesn't mean we can't still see religion as a good, as a, like a hyper good, that, as Charles Taylor would put it, right? One that the community itself is committed to in a way that facilitates others. Right. Not in the sense of necessarily, and definitely not in the sense of coercing people to the true faith, but in a sense that actually says this is the end of this concerns the ends of the person.
So in this sort of public commitment to religion as a good, you mentioned the UK and Australia and the question of establishment. And I guess I want to maybe drill down a bit more. How would your proposal differ from a sort of soft establishment or a sort of maybe civic religion is another term we might try and think of? Is it similar or is it different than a soft establishment of religion?
Look, I mean, I spent time in the United Kingdom and I quite liked establishment, so okay, maybe that's where I'm going from. You're from North America, and so this is anathema to you. But it's sort of I think there's a problem for religious liberty, and I think we're beginning to see it now. If you establish a political community on the understanding that we're agnostic as to any ultimate meaning, right, and that we're agnostic as to there being some collective good, or that we're agnostic as to that there can be a relationship with God. Because then you get into this idea, well, we're just this neutral space for facilitating individual conceptions of the good or personal autonomy or so on. At which point you start then raising the questions we're seeing very much to the fore now. And in Australia as well, seeing very much to the fore. Yeah. Why care about religious liberty? Yeah. You know, why is that something we should care about? When really what we're all interested in is a political community that facilitates my authenticity or my individual integrity. Perhaps even facilitates against religious communities, right? So when I say, I'm quite enamored with in the UK, it's because, they have an understanding that it frames a political community as serving, as existing for something other than itself as well, or rather civil authority existing for something other than itself, namely to facilitate something for persons, right? Collectively as communities. And it also has an understanding, you say soft establishment. Yes, because, in the United Kingdom, they see themselves as basically providing a voice to religious communities as such against any forms of, secularity or secularism that would try to exclude their voices from public life and so on. In the Australian context, I think it's a really interesting question. There's more interesting scholarship now, I think, coming out that's trying to say that this kind of very narrow or very simplistic secularist narrative of sort of the Australian origins is some great breakaway from any religious underpinnings or any concern for religion, and actually that they were all deeply just almost secular to the point of anti-religious, is just not really quite right. That there is always been a commitment of some kind. And I think it's an interesting question as to what that looks like. It's not something I've been looking into particularly largely in the Australian context, but you know, the book I've written, yes, it has the UK and Europe, and it talks about America and tries to use that as a bit of a contrast in part of American scholarship. But I would hope that it has some appeal regardless of where you are, especially if you're being shaped by this, especially in countries like ours that have been shaped by a much longer history, I think, of church and state, or before that, spiritual and temporal authority that goes back much further than simply, you know, the American Revolution or the French Revolution.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess a couple of questions spring to mind. The first maybe is to, as you say, clarify that your proposal isn't a sort of universal suggestion of what should be adopted in every country in the world. It's more tied to specific countries' historical connections with a lived faith.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? I mean,
I think that's the argument of liberalism, right? Is that everybody should have individual rights, autonomy, and equality. Whereas your proposal with religion as a public good incarnated in something like the Church of England and in Anglican faith that might be seen by some as exclusionary to other faiths, but maybe is justified arguably because of the historical connection there.
I mean, the history that I discuss, though, is, you know, it's a shared history, right? So it's, you know, you're talking about, like, this is the interesting thing in political theology is when people start appealing to Augustine, it's almost like they're going back to, you know, the primary source. So that sort of wins the argument, right? Because it's someone who everyone uses regardless of where you are. If you're at least in the North American, European, and our derivatives context, right? But you know, so there is something, there is, you'd hope that I would hope that something you write there, although I see it as couched in a history, that hopefully that history sort of still says something that's somewhat universal. But I think the more difficult question for something like what I've written would be, well, what do you say in a country like Indonesia or something like this, right? Or a country like Singapore and so on. And I think that's really fascinating. I think if you're talking about, say, religious liberty in Indonesia, where you've got, like, you know, the constitutional commitment to Pancasila, and you've got a constitutional commitment to the one God, you know, it's said to be secular, but it has really quite an Islamic overtone, then you'd be thinking about how do you weave religious liberty into that narrative, I think. You know, you can't just simply, you know, there was a time, and I think I had a student, a PhD student from Indonesia, and reading some of the stuff around this, you know, there was a time when certain activists wanted to just kind of like, they'd gone off, you know how some students, they go to like the Kennedy School at Harvard, and then they go, oh, I'm going to go back to my country, I'm going to do the Kennedy School thing, or whatever, you know. And so they're a bit like that, like, let's just get to walk it and beam them in there.
Legal transplants, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just nonsense. You know, well, good luck to you. But so I think there's something there about, you know, you do have to probably start thinking about how you weave it into the narratives of that political community, which may be complex and so on. So there's hopefully something in what I've written for wider audiences, but you know, if you're interested in a longer view, historical view of Western conversations on religious liberty, then that's kind of what I'm aiming at.
Well, I mean, I think Indonesia is actually a really interesting example in the sense that they have a specific small list of registered religions. Mm. Everybody has to nominate themselves, you know, to belong to one of those religions. Anyone who's not a member of one of the identified religions, you know, there's issues with marriage and all sorts of questions. Intermarriage is problematic. Conversion is problematic. But I know that you're not proposing a sort of vision of a public commitment to religion that is intentionally exclusionary or is going to suppress religious freedom. Mm-hmm. And in the book, you talk about how your model can exist within a pluralist society. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? How does pluralism fit within your conception of communities of charity?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, your example is fascinating because, I mean, you get into a whole bunch of problems. Like, one is just, you know, so I say, state clearly in the book, you know, religious liberty considers two things. One is this formation of these communities. Then, so the other is that religious truth to be true must be accepted by the person, right? So it's non-coerced. And I argue that along with other people to say that's the nature of truth that is adopted as personal in that sense, right? And so, you know, you can't have, so there are European cases about this again, you know, you can't have, there's one about, you know, I can't remember what country, but they were trying to tell a school teacher she'd lose her job if she didn't stop being an evangelical, right? And the court says it's fundamentally contrary to religious liberty. And I think that's right? You can't, there's a non-coercion principle there. And so that remains, right? So in the Indonesian context, you have a real problem there. There's also, just to pick up on something you're saying there about personal law and so on, I think this is not something I go into in the book, but there's a really interesting question that I think is being debated a bit more in, you know, sort of constitutional discourse, especially with certain strands of Catholic legal theory, about the role the law can take and if not coercing people, at least directing people. Now, I say in this book, you know, along with Aquinas, you know, the law doesn't exist just simply to create a space for persons to do their own thing, but actually has a relationship to virtue, right? To cultivating virtue in a community. But, you know, that means that there is still a distinction between, say, always between, say, the religious community and law or civil authority. And that's something that political theology, Christian thought, injected into the life of the community, right? Such that it would be very difficult for me to say, you know, no, we should sort of regulate people's religious identities in this kind of legal fashion, right? That there has to be, we have to now drill it down into a matter of law. There needs to be, it's in my mind, some absence of law. But to your substantive point, sorry, I was just riffing on what you were saying, but the substantive point about pluralism and and under my understanding. So yes, I have my understanding of religious liberty emanates out of a lot of Christian thinking. And then we have the difficulty of multiple communities and persons of different faiths and so on, right? So say there's non-coercion, but then I also try to argue that, you know, having a central case of religious liberty allows for analogies or allows for similarities or allows for a family of relationships. So at one point, I talk about displaced agreement, which we may not agree entirely on everything, but we agree in part on what this pursuit is. Or a good image, I think, is what Pope Francis gives, where he says society is a polyhedron rather than a sphere. So the liberal egalitarian understanding, in ways, is quite like a sphere, because everyone must cohere to the center in exactly the same way. And namely, they must all respect some principle of self-determination, right? Increasingly so. So that's a sphere, right? Everything's homogenized to the same. You know, we like to think of our society as heterogeneous, but it's quite similar. We're quite homogenous, right? Whereas he says society is a polyhedron, namely, yeah, we cohere because we're trying to pursue certain goods in common, right? Education, welfare, charity, whatever it is. But we do so with differences, right? So those different planes of a polyhedron, we do so differently. And I think that's a nice image for what should be a goal there, in that we are a political community, right? So there isn't just a, we're not just a bunch of what is this strange writer talks about, you know, Benedict options everywhere. Anyway, we're not just a bunch of kind of isolated monads, right? But we are also engaging this in slightly different manner. So schools, religious schools, a big debate in Australia. Religious schools want to be able to select their teachers based on shared religious ethos and beliefs and doctrine and so on and practices. That, to many people, is problematic, and we shouldn't allow it because it's against the notion that the school should be accommodating the self-determination of these prospective teachers, right? But I say, well, no. Well, the school is engaging in the good of education. It is doing so in a way that tries to cultivate character as a community that sees itself on a path together, cultivating the virtues of their students and so on. And it does so in a particularly different, in a different way in certain particulars. But it's one of those planes making up what we call the public. So that's how so when you talk about pluralism, I see it in a similar way, right? You know, so they're not sheerly different, but there is difference, right? And so, but that difference can be understood as still nevertheless part of some sort of joint enterprise.
Well, when we talk about pluralism, I think often we understand pluralism as a diversity of religious faiths. We may also, I guess, include maybe the demographic trend in some countries towards people who don't identify as religious, but have sort of spiritual beliefs that maybe to them take the role of religion that would otherwise be in other people's lives. And then we have cases of atheists and agnostics and, you know, skeptics and a variety there. How would you explain your proposal to them? Would they sort of be encompassed in this vision of a public commitment to true religion, or would they, I don't know, be on the outside looking in and feel excluded that they're a citizen, but not, you know, part of this public commitment to religion?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So, I mean, you could answer that in a few ways. So one is just, if it was a question of religious liberty, like some question before, it depends on what the context is, right? So
sure, yeah.
If it's about, you know, someone being coerced into a religion when actually they want to be a free spirit doing whatever, then okay, well then I think it's right to say that no person should be coerced into adopting a religious faith like that. Then if we're talking about, you know, questions like, there was a really fascinating little one in the news, actually. Let's just take that. So up near you, I think it was actually at USQ. Maybe you had some finger in this one.
I don't think so.
No, it was the Satanists who wanted the chaplaincy. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard.
So it's either at USQ. Does USQ have a hospital?
No, we don't.
Okay, so or is it a hospital in the region or something? Anyway, the question faced there was, you have a chaplaincy room.
Yeah.
And I think it was a USQ chaplaincy room. So something for you to go have some fun with.
But I'll have to research this. Yeah.
But the Satanists wanted their labels up in the room as well. And you can see what the argument here is, right? Sort of this the fair and equal treatment demands an all comers approach.
Yeah.
You
get very, I guess, sorry to interrupt, but
no, go.
Similar examples with, you know, how many deliberative bodies give prayers at their opening,
yeah, right.
Town councils and legislatures, and they have a practice of having a chaplain from a local church come in and give the invocation. And in the US, there's a lot of lawsuits by, it might be Satanists, it might be Wiccans, it might be atheists who say, well, I should be allowed to come in and give the invocation then, just as well as the Anglican minister or the Catholic priest. Mm.
I think that's right. So in this case, I thought it was fascinating, the one that I'm pretty sure was up near your neck of the woods, but because, you know, there's sort of two things. I'll get to something a bit more substantive, but there's sort of two things there. One is, you could sense that the people are trolling, right? They're sort of trying to, you know, show up ludicrousness, in which case I don't think a civil authority of this actually has to pay attention to that, right? I think that somebody is trying to draw mockery. I don't think so. But then if they're actually serious, well, then I think there are genuine questions about, well, size, practicality, and these sorts of things, right? So, and then to the more substantive one about the prayers and so on, these locations. I don't think somebody stops being a citizen because there are prayers of a nature that they don't fully on board with, right?
Or, sure.
There's a certain American line of doctrine that I think the Supreme Court is now moving slightly against, you know, that Justice O'Connor line around endorsement, that if you engage in this, or you see Luke Beck tries to argue it in his book on Section 116, right? Some sort of endorsement theory, that if you engage in acts of religiosity in public life, then that you are making other people and turning them, rendering them into outsiders. And I think that's kind of, it's sort of like saying, well, if you take somewhere like the United Kingdom, you know, you have the coronation of the Queen, or you have the bishops in the House of Lords and so on. I mean, in what sense then are people who are non-Christians or even non-Anglican Church of England types, are they rendered outlaws? you know, in that environment. So I would have real questions over that. But I think your point about, sort of individual spiritualities and so on. Yeah, I mean, if you read my book, and you probably would see that. I mean, I see a lot of that is, that's kind of a lot of the shape of contemporary religion that is developed out of, well, saying it developed out of is probably a bit too much, but it's at least at one with or echoing a lot of liberal discourse. And I think that there are problems with it. So if you're talking about it as a matter of what should a political community promote or be interested in, then, what is it? Robert Bella has the individual who talks about the sweet, quiet voice whispering me to consume. Then that's not something that I think a political community should be committed to, but nor is it something that I think you then go about exterminating. In the sense of, like, if there's a genuine question of religious liberty that arises, you know, somebody's being coerced or something, then that would have to be dealt with in context.
Is Bella the one who gives the Sheilaism?
That's it. That's it. That's what
yeah,
exactly.
Sheila what and her. Sheila. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's well, so maybe Sheilaism is a really good example.
Go ahead.
And the UK is also a great example for this. I mean, I know you're aware of the statistics of demographic trends in the UK, which I think are accelerated far more than in Australia or Canada, and definitely far more than US, which still maintains a very high self-identification of religious affiliation. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, if we are at or soon will be at a point where a majority of the citizens no longer identify as Christian, or perhaps in the future, even a member of a traditional monotheistic faith, does your thesis, does it still have a place? Is it sort of a preservation and caretaker role of the country's traditional association with religion? Or is it somehow at a clash with what, I don't know, the direction society seems to be going, whether for good or ill?
Yeah, interesting. I think that's another, to my mind, a little column A, a little column B. So okay. yes, it matters in the sense that, when you're trying to persuade, you're trying to persuade that this is a good vision or good political imaginary, as we said before, right?
Yeah.
And if no one's persuaded, then no one's persuaded, right?
Sure.
And I think it also depends, I say this a few times in the book, it also depends on, I think religious liberty, one thing it depends on, and I think is a real struggle in Australia at the moment, is that it depends on seeing good, such that it matters. So knowing that these communities, it's not just about that they want their own turf. So some people, there's a more than a hint of, more than a whiff of libertarianism that goes through religious liberty discourse. And they talk about it as just, I won my turf, right? I won my backyard. And it kind of renders the group like a big individual. But I think that has the problems that I was saying. It doesn't really give a reason for why religious liberty. Whereas I think it will depend as a matter of public consciousness on knowing that these are communities that are seeking good, right? That are seeking to do good, the way I talk about it as solidarity, fraternity, and charity, right? So if you find that it's just precipitously, turning into a post-religious environment, although that I should complicate that, because I don't think you'd get rid of religion, it just arises in these different new forms. But if it turns into a way that's post against all that other stuff, then you'd have a real problem. Now I don't follow the social science on this deeply or anything. So, but I am always slightly skeptical of, these affiliation, these identification surveys, in the sense that, like, I think I try and say in this book, I try and state a suspicion at least that I think, Alistair McIntyre says in, I think After Virtue, he says, he assumes that most people are proto-Aristotelians, that they understand that there is a good, an end, a purpose to their actions. Education has a purpose, that their life has a narrative meaning that orients them towards an end. And they're proto in the sense they don't know Aristotle, but they live their lives like this, right? So in my book, I'm trying to say, here's a vision of a good society in which religious liberty is cared for under this larger framework of how we understand ourselves in community with each other. And hopefully it's attractive, right? Yes. It's almost like that's kind of, and hopefully it's attractive because it touches on things that people genuinely care about. So that they have rich community life with each other, that they have relationships of solidarity, that their work is given meaning, that they can bring their whole selves into, including their community, to contribute to forming the public life, you know, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So you're right. If there is this movement that then just evacuates these meanings, then you have a problem, I think, in actually trying to convince people that, say, religious liberty here is actually something worth caring about. But hopefully there is at least enough kind of intuitive or even cultural religious capital, something like that, that then actually touches on something. Otherwise, you get into what Pope Benedict called creative minorities, which is he's arguing it's about people trying to articulate what the goods of society are, even when society itself may have given up on them or forgotten. Oliver O'Donovan, political theologian, talks about this as the point of political theology, is to explicate the meaning of some of our political concepts when we may have forgotten what they mean.
Yeah. Well, and I may have given an overly pessimistic sort of view of where religious affiliation will evolve in the UK. We can also hypothesize, you know, religious reawakenings. Right. You know, we have a lot of historical examples of that happening in a lot of countries. Let's maybe look at the flip side, the optimistic picture. Let's say your book is read by the High Court of Australia, and they say, wow, Joel Harrison, you've got it right. We're going to try and operationalize this sort of vision. So you're a constitutional law teacher just like me. Mm-hmm. Is there, have you thought about how would doctrinal tests look differently, or how the law formally would look differently? Or is this more a matter of sort of a compassionate heart and a different weighing of values when it comes to making decisions? I don't know if I've asked that
question. No, it's a good question. I actually start the book by saying something like, I'm not hugely interested in courts per se. Because I think, and it's one that I don't have a finalized view on, but I think there is a real problem in how we've rendered our political discourse into legal rights discourse, right? So that's where we go. So even if you take in Australia at the moment, we've had these, as you know quite well also, we've had these interminable reviews.
Yes.
We had before the Ruddock Review, the religious discrimination bills times two, the Labor Party's proposal on schools, the AHRC has done a bunch of them, the Law Reform Commission is now doing one. It's kind of ridiculous, right? Because it actually fuels a actual culture war, because like even the dynamics of it, you literally fuels a culture war, because what do you need as a organization? You need donor money. And so you have to keep showing them what you're doing, namely these submissions to these groups and who you're fighting, who your enemies are, and blah, and all this sort of stuff. Anyway, and when you read the submissions for all of this, it's generally framed in very legalistic manner, right? Here is what the law should be. Here is how we use the law to ensure this happens. Da, 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 da. And I have, and a lot of religious groups even, it's fascinating to see how they started not that long ago, you know, acting, saying we don't want a Bill of Rights. Now they're saying we really want a Religious Freedom Act, right?
Yes.
And it's kind of like a mini Bill of Rights coming in.
Yeah.
And I think that's all, you know, there's a number of problematic things there, but I think, you know, so my thing about, you know, would it be about court doctrine and so on? Yes, hopefully, you know, because that's where we are. But I do try and say, I think it's about actually probably more about deliberative mechanisms, right? Try and write it in terms of like, how do we think about together? What should the shape of our society be and so on? But if we do talk about it in terms of doctrine, I think I suggested a couple of places, you know, so instead of the focus simply being on the individual, well, actually no courts taking into account what the lay of the land is amongst various groups. So my example about Guy who wanted to open air funeral pyre, and the court looked into whether the various Hindu councils in the United Kingdom regard this as necessary and so on. And in the context of saying, you know, this would be quite a development. Now, the case was decided in the end on the grounds of SAD did go through on this basis. I think that's not a bad way to approach it, as in to start asking questions about how do we accommodate communities, right? And then Guy's argument may not be with the law as such, it may be with his own community to have a discussion there about what the same thing, you know, if you take a case, you'd be well, you'd know well as well, Amsalam in Canada, right? Which was about, you know, pitted the individual's understanding of Jewish requirements against the Frasuka, against the community's understanding, right? And the Supreme Court of Canada goes with the individual, right? Now, to my mind, that kind of overrides elements of communal deliberation that can take place. So I'm much more interested in that sort of thing, which I guess fits with my general thinking that we can get into problematic discourse when we think of this as just simply about law, simply about my appeal to rights versus your appeal to rights. And now if the High Court read my book, that's good enough for me.
Exactly. Well, I realize we're running out of time, so I guess I better wrap up. I'll just ask, where do you go from here? Are you going to keep sort of working and articulating this political imaginary, or are you moving on to some related or different topics? What do you have planned?
I think I mentioned, I'm trying to think through some of the dynamics in these interminable reviews, right, in Australia. Yeah. So trying to think about Australia a little bit. And then, yes, I'm still writing about some of the elements that you find in my book and my challenges posed to liberal egalitarian writing. But I think I perhaps began our conversation with saying that partly, you know, this book, by the time I finished it, it's about religious liberty, but I don't think you can understand religious liberty outside of what we call political imaginary or some grand political theory or whatever we want to call it, right? And so I'm increasingly also interested in just how constitutionalism, our understandings of constitutionalism, how they frame religion or how they understand theological argument and so on. So, you know, not just religious liberty as one doctrine, but actually questions about how we order constitutional systems, right? So, you know, even talking about things like sovereignty, right? So I've got something coming out on sovereignty in a little bit, how we understand, you know, how people think about things like federalism, separation of powers, all these sorts of things, constitutionalism, generally, and how it relates to histories of religious theological discourse, and how liberal constitutionalists may want to sort of elide that or occlude it or separate it off, and challenges that are being posed there.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I really appreciate you talking to me about the book. I really enjoyed reading it. I thought it was a very fascinating, but measured, but provocative in a good sort of way of thought-provoking. And, right. You know, we come from very different viewpoints on a lot of law and religion probably issues, but I really enjoyed reading it, and I would definitely recommend that listeners seek it out.
Thanks, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
Great. For those of you listening, again, the book is Post-Liberal Religious Liberty, Forming Communities of Charity, published by Cambridge University Press. I'll put a link to the publisher's website for the book in the episode notes. If you have questions or thoughts about the episode, please email me at jeremy.patrick@usq.edu.au. I may feature listener comments in a segment on a future episode. Last episode, I recommended the Legal Spirits podcast from the St. John Center for Law and Religion. This time around, I'd like to recommend a podcast titled Interactions from the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University. And I'll also put a link to that in the episode notes. I'll be back in 2 months with another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. Until then, I'm Jeremy Patrick, and thanks for listening.